How are you on profanity?
Profanity's fine. Okay. We incentivize it in some of our conversations.
It's fucking cool. All right, yeah. Good. I'm from New Jersey, so where fuck is our word for so.
Well, now that we've got all that out of the way,
it's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Yeah.
You must have worked in construction in your youth.
I did a little. I'm from a long line of carpenters and construction workers, so that may have something to do with it. I think it's just mostly where I, you know, fucking grew up, rather than the reverse, which was not true.
I don't think it's possible to get through a one-hour conversation involving big tech and social media platforms without involving a little bit of profanity. It's just undoable. Quick intro, it is another Axis of Easy. This could be salon number 30, but we've been talking about splitting the guests out into a separate channel. So this might be interview number one or debriefing number one. I'm Mark Jeftovic. We have Jesse Hirsch from the Ottawa Valley, Charles Hugh Smith from Hawaii, and joining us today, very special guest, Doc Searles. And you're coming in from where?
Santa Barbara, California.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto from 1999, which was co-authored with Christopher Locke and David Weinberger. And then your later book, The Intention Economy, huge book for me. I gave out a copy to every member of the EasyDNS staff the year it came out. And you are an alumni fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. You've been involved in the Linux Journal from the word go, and you oversee Project VRM and that mailing list at the Berkman Center. I think I got most of the
bullet
points.
That's most of it. I would add Rick Levine was the fourth author, a co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I just heard from him this morning because if you look me up on Google, it says you may also be searching for, and they show a little picture of Christopher Locke, and that's not Chris. And Rick Levine, it shows some astrologer, also named Rick Levine. So I want to give him some props because he's a brilliant guy.
Yeah, and then somebody should edit the Wikipedia page because I went there to see who the co-authors were because I couldn't remember it off the top of my head. So
all Wikipedia pages need work right now.
Yes.
Jump on it, everybody.
Stop listening to this show and go edit a Wikipedia page for Christ. Okay.
Although, why don't we use that as a place to start? I mean, you know, Doc, I was reading your latest blog post, and it, from a narrative perspective, sort of suggested that, you know, with one chapter closing, a new one begins. And it's not just the kind of revisionist history that we've witnessed in the last 4 years, but the way in which we're trying to get a sense of that history, the way in which it's felt as if history is happening in real time. So I'm curious, where do you see yourself in this moment of history? You know, partly because in the sort of preamble to the show, we're sort of acknowledging both the influence you've had on us, but I think you've been up there in terms of some of the poets, the journalists, the storytellers, in terms of the open source world and the open source culture that have really given it body and life. So without dwelling too much on the past, you know, where are we now? Where are you now? And where do you think we're going when it comes to...
Oh, my God. There's too much there.
Yes, a very big picture.
I'll just go back to the blog post. So if you go to my blog, with a shortcut for which is doc.searles.com, you'll see the last post was... I forget even what it was titled, but my point was that the... actually, let me just take a quick look because I was asked about it. Actually, I was looking at something else. Okay. Oh, it's too complicated. Everything's too... we were talking about obscenities before. Everything's too complicated. Anyway, it's you know, we're... In journalism, I'm a journalist, right? And journalists write stories. That's what they do. And stories are not accurate. Stories are selective by nature because... They consist of, there are always three elements to any story. It doesn't matter what the story is. It could be a sports story, could be a politics story, could be a human interest story, could be any kind of story, a war story. you have a protagonist, you have character. You have character or characters, which could be a team, it could be a cause. You have problem, you have struggle, and you have movement. And that movement is always toward a resolution. That's what keeps you interested in the story. You take out any of those, and the story goes away. With the Holocaust, for example, I mean, people knew for many years that, you know, for a decade anyway, that, you know, millions of people had been killed. But it was the Diary of Anne Frank that really kind of brought it home for a lot of people. With the killing fields in Cambodia, we're not even called the killing fields until the movie was made. But before that, I remember hearing on the evening news, and I wrote about this in another post called Where Journalism Fails, that I remember it was in the late 70s. I was watching the CBS evening news, and there was a guy named Hughes Rudd who was filling in for, I guess, Walter Cronkite, who said offhandedly, well, between 500,000 and 1 million people have died in Cambodia. Remember Cambodia? We bombed that place, and it all got unstable after that, and nobody's known what's going on. Well, it turns out a lot of people died. Like, an enormous number of people back after this. And then they went to like four or five other stories that were next to 500,000 or 1 million people being killed, utterly trivial. And it wasn't until a guy named Sidney Schamberg wrote the story of a guy named Dith Pran about the about just one character, one guy, his driver, I guess it was, or his translator, and how he survived what later became called The Killing Fields, which I think, you know, was the name of the movie. But, and the movie was made about that, about Sidney Schamberg and this one guy. It's so anyway, we've had the Donald Trump story for like 4 years now. And it ended, you know, the election story ended. Even when Fox News says we have president-elect and his name is Biden, we're in the epilogue. That's what was the name of the title. We're in the epilogue now.
Brought it up.
We're in the epilogue. So we're in the, but it doesn't mean it's over. Doesn't mean it isn't complicated. It means that human interest is formatted by stories, right? It's fundamentally formatted by stories. So you're asking what I'm doing now. I mean, I am, among other things, I think probably more, at least intellectually, I'm trying to make full sense of two people. One is George Lakoff, who's a friend, and he's a linguist, and the other, and he has a lot of stuff to say, but I'm not going to go into him yet. And the other is Marshall McLuhan and his son and grandson, who are Eric and Andrew, who are friends as well. Not as close as I am with George, but Eric sadly is gone now. He's a little bit of a mentor after I discovered McLuhan again, his dad. But they, you know, they pointed out that every new medium, which is that every new technology that we use, not only extends us. That was the point of his magnum opus back in the 60s, Understanding Media, the Extensions of Man. We were extended by our things. You know, this mouse extends my hand, you know, this pen extends my fingers, and my senses suffuse this as well, that it becomes part of me while I'm using it. This is part of the human condition, and every new technology does that. And we have these now, and these, you know, these rectangles we carry around are now parts of us. We feel lost almost without them. And that all technologies do four things. These are the laws of media, which Marshall came up with Eric, his son. And they say all of them do what they call a tetrad. They do four things. They enhance, they extend, they obsolesce, and they reverse. And so if we look, for example, at social media, what social media did was it enhanced gossip. It enhanced conviviality. It obsolesced not only journalism, it obsolesced every other medium. I mean, watch what's happening to television right now. It's all being sucked into YouTube and what we're doing right now. We don't need a TV network to do what we're doing now. You know, but it also retrieved each of these things. We're retrieving television. We're retrieving old-fashioned video. Podcasts retrieve, you know, while it obsolesces talk radio, it's also retrieving a lot of talk radio. And it's reversing into tribalism. It's reversing into the worst of what gossip can do. It is just armor-plated and nuclear-tipped every kind of gossip you can imagine. And I just made that up, but that's pretty much what it did.
Wonderful. It's good.
and it is amplified what they call homophily. the they being, I don't know, anthropologists or whatever, but the tendency we have to group with our own kind, whatever that happens to be. And that's, you know, Zuckerberg didn't know he was doing that. The guys that invented Twitter didn't know they were doing that. And this is part of the rearview mirror we were talking earlier about with Jesse, that, you know, we see these things in hindsight. And, you know, I don't think we can anticipate all these things happening, but we can at least admit that these things change us utterly. That's, you know, and I mean, one of the things that McLuhan said is that it's hard to acknowledge that radio caused both Hitler and Gandhi. You take away radio, you don't have either of those guys. You take away social media and email before that, you not only don't have Trump, you don't have Obama. Without email and his email campaign, and without, for that matter, the internet, we probably wouldn't have Obama. We'd have had somebody else. But you know, it isn't so much that they were made smart use of those things, is that those media were in the world busy changing everybody, and you know, they were fortunate in that respect. I think that Trump is a man of his time and of his medium, and but I also think that, I don't know how many Shakespeare plays talk about or portray people like Trump, but they don't come to good ends. It's just another thought that I have, you know, that's about that. But that's how stories go. And we want stories to end. We want other stories to come in again. So those two things.
Well, we've heard the tetrad here a couple of times because Jesse's an art student of McLuhan, and so that comes up from episode to episode. Were you about to say something, Jesse or Charles?
Well, I'm real interested in George Lakoff. I lived in Berkeley for 30 years. And of course, last I heard, he was a professor at UCB. And he's been around for decades in terms of his insights into the use of language. And I'd like to hear you say a little bit more about George's work.
I'll do it briefly. I'm having trouble getting in touch with George, and he's been quiet, and that bothers me. So I'll just put that there and not try and interpret it. This election was a triumph for George, and the backstory in that, I'll try and make it as brief as I can, is that in 1994, I think it was, that George who's a Democrat, was watching the Republican National Convention, and Dan Quayle, the former vice president under George Bush the Elder, uttered this phrase about progressive taxation, or you know, which is where rich people get higher, you know, there are tax brackets and rich people pay more than poor people on a percentage basis. And Dan Quayle said about that system, "Why should the best people be punished?" And it was an applause line. And George sat there and thought, "I'm appalled by that. What makes some people better than other people? What makes rich people better than poor people? Why is taxation punishment?" And then he thought, he's from New Jersey, like I am. He thought, oh, fuck, I'm a Democrat and I'm a linguist. So obviously they're speaking something I don't understand, but I'm a linguist. I should unpack this. So he did. And he spent about a year, at the end of which I came out with a book called, and I may have it right here. I know it's here somewhere. It's called Moral Politics, What Conservatives Know That Liberals Don't. And he realized that both liberals and conservatives had a subconscious model of the country as a family. And I should just digress into cognitive linguistics and metaphor for a moment. We think and talk metaphorically. That was his fundamental insight. We can't help it. Everything we say and do and think and say has a metaphorical basis of some kind. Most of it's unconscious. You can see the conscious stuff if we talk about say time. When we say that we waste time, spend it, set it aside, invest it, use it wisely, we're saying time is money. We borrow the language of money. We borrow the frame of money when we talk about time. Never do we actually speak in the scientific definition of time. Most of us wouldn't be able to say exactly what time is. Same with life. Life is a journey. That's why birth is arrival and death is departure, and choices are crossroads, careers are paths. We get stuck in a rut, we fall off the wagon, we go in the fast lane. It's endless. It's very hard to talk about life without using the language of travel. It's hard to talk about politics without somehow going to the concept of the country as a family. And we talk about the motherland, the fatherland, you know, our brothers in arms, you know, my band of brothers, you know, the it's there's the concept of the country as a family. What George noticed was that there are different models of the family for liberals and conservatives. For conservatives, he says, we have a strict father model. The strict father model starts with the assumption that the world's a dangerous place. The family is the fundamental unit for facing the dangers of the world. You need somebody physically strong in charge of that. That's your dad. That's the dad, the father of the country, the George Washington. And he teaches primarily through rewards and punishments. You reward good behavior, you punish bad behavior. And you learn things like thrift and self-denial. All the terms that we use in our moral frameworks, including, say, generosity and caring, are in there. They're just low priority, because the high priority is surviving in this world. And there are things like you get respect out of that, and others respect you because you're big and you're strong. That, and on the other side, he said, when Ronald Reagan talked about the nation as a family, he talked in the shining city on the hill and all that. His model was the strict father model, and he played that role. He played the strict father role. Never mind that his own family life was screwed up, that he'd been married at least twice, I don't remember. But that didn't matter. He played this role of the strong man, as it were. He was gentle as well as strong, but he was strong, he was tough. And he could stand up, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And he played that role very well. And that's why we look back on him. He's, he was a good guy. He played that role. On the other side, on the liberal side, on the Democratic side, which George rebranded progressive, by the way. He didn't want to use the term liberal. He preferred progressive. He said that we have a model of the family on the left as well, which is that it's a nurturant parent model, but it's not strong mother. It's rather based on caring. It's based on the assumption the world is a good place and that everybody should be given a chance and everybody should be cared for. And it's fundamentally about caring. You lift up the people that are struggling. You reach out. You have decency about you. But basically it comes from a caring position and is a caring model of the country and a caring model of the family. What we had in this election was the epitome of those two fighting against each other. Trump played to the hilt about as strong a strongman as he could. And that's why a lot of people who share the model of the country as a family loved him, still love him. It didn't matter that he's been married three times, that he's cheated on all these women, that, you know, grab her by the pussy, all that stuff. That just showed off what kind of a dude he was. Fine. If he's all those things, he's going to protect us from the immigrants. He's going to protect us from other countries. He's going to watch out for us. And he's our guy. And they like him like they like, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine who's in the tech business, who was and still is from a professional wrestling family, and even did some himself. I always thought he looked suspiciously fit, but anyway. That, by the way, is Daniel Lewin. He's the head of the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. He said, it's totally, the whole Trump playbook is right out of professional wrestling. And everybody in professional wrestling is that kind of a person, right? They're a character. He's pure character. And he, to tie these two things together with journalism, what Trump did was hack journalism by being a character and by characterizing others. You know, low energy Jeb, you know, crooked Hillary, you know, sleepy Joe, you know, little Mario. He belittles other people on purpose to constantly characterize them. And people care about character, and they care about characterization, whether they like it or not. And he stayed endlessly interesting, you know. So that is, you know, why MSNBC and CNN just can't help covering this dude, because he's a great story, and he makes great story. And but he plays the strong man. And what we had on the other side with Biden was the most nurturant person possible. I mean, I don't know if he is as nurturant as he seems to be, but boy, that it seems to fit. I mean, the campaign made a shoe and it fits right on him. He rides the train. He shares lunch with people. He hugs the kids, kisses people on the head. You know, he carries a list of soldiers that have died in his jacket and he calls them up the families. I mean, he's a caring guy. And that, you know, George's advice to the Democrats is go to your strength, which is you care about people. That's it. You're about caring about people. And that campaign played it perfectly. Build Back Better, you know, it's constructive. It's not destructive. He's not reacting, you know. Anyway, I could go on.
I agree very much with both your analysis and George's deeper work in terms of the intersection of narrative and values and the way in which narratives can can reinforce the circuits that we associate with those values. But what I was hearing, especially at the end of your description, you know, was the larger meta narrative of conflict or of tribalism, as you sort of inferred earlier. Because, you know, one of the ways I've been thinking about QAnon, which is not my own idea, but I've been certainly riffing on it, is, you know, QAnon as a live action role-playing game. That, you know, QAnon combines both an immersive narrative with a kind of video game feel that is all-encompassing, right? It's what allows QAnon to have almost a religious-like fervor, because people can fully immerse themselves in the game. They can sort of take on, and to them it's not fictional, it's very much real, but they get to be players in a global conspiracy.
That's a good analysis. I like that. I think,
you know,
that's
fight that. Pedophiles and it matches narratives on the left, that absolutely, whether it was to defeat Trump or, you know, whether it's fighting for a more socially just society, there's similar heroism, there's similar valor, but in both cases these narratives are divergent. And they're facilitating a greater cultural divergence in which, you know, and it's not binary. I think the split happening in American society is not just left and right. It's everybody. It's a split in all directions. It's easier to characterize it as left versus right or urban versus rural or coastal versus middle America. But I see it more as a split in as many possible directions, hence the tribalism. So I'm in flipping that back as a question, and Mark, feel free to jump in before, you know, Doc does. What role does narrative play in healing that? Is there a way, you know, do we have to go post-social media to get post-tribal? Or is within our current epoch, within our current media phase, is there a way for narrative? Is there a way for value-based storytelling or even value-based policy to try to bridge this divide? Because even though Trump may be at least appearing to be defeated, QAnon is going to be empowered by the narrative he's putting forward, especially his victimization and the fraud and all the other nonsense. All of that is fuel for the QAnon fire, which is going to be a real fly in the ointment for the Biden presidency, let alone an open insurrection that, again, puts emphasis on the need to be thinking of narratives and to be thinking of cultures that counter this raging tribalism.
Well, I'll jump in quickly then and say, first off, a thought that occurred to me, Doc, while you were talking about, you know, how Trump almost behaves like a professional wrestler. There's a blogger called Caitlin Johnstone.
Yeah, I know her. Yeah, I don't know her personally, but I read her stuff. Yeah,
and if you've she wrote, I'd say midway through the term, she said, "Has it ever occurred to anybody that Donald Trump is a member of the WWE Hall of Fame because he was involved in the promotion and she meant it more as like it's a metaphor for the entire political system, that it's more theater than anything else. And we talk about that a lot on this show, how almost the left-right dichotomy is a false dichotomy. I mean, it's real and it's very prevalent in all of our lives, But we look at it, when we try to look through that dichotomy and we think where we see the world going, the left-right split is almost symbolic. The more important splits are between centralization and decentralization, or between protocols and platforms. And we think that's where the epic struggles of the very near future are going to occur. We all bring
Which, to very briefly phrase what Mark is saying in McLuhan terms, you know, ideology is the figure, technology is the ground, right? The battle of left and right is the figure. The battle between platforms and protocols is the ground. Sorry, Mark, continue.
No, that's okay. You know, my one sound signal died again in the middle of all that. So anyhow, and where was I going with that? I was going with that to say that when all of this internet stuff came along, everybody became very hopeful that this was going to be a uniting force and everyone gets a voice. And then what's happened instead is every voice adds to a polarization on one side or the other. You know, we all bring a different political perspective into this thing. I'm sort of the redheaded stepchild because I'm a libertarian, so I'm neither liberal or conservative. I'm reviled by everyone. And so I try to sort of run up the center of this massive football pylon. But as far as this narrative thing, I mean, sometimes I sort of mislabel it as we all have to try and get back towards the center. But we talked about that last week. It isn't really centrism we want to get to. It's almost, but somehow take the edge off of this polarity, which the big tech platforms optimize for. I mean, you get a dopamine hit when someone is screaming at you as much as when you're screaming at somebody else. And they're engineering for this, and they're engineering for polarity. They know that anger gets circulated faster than happiness. So they're going to show you stuff in your feed that they know is going to rile you, I think intentionally. We were talking about that.
Oh, yeah, no, it's so programmed in. It's programmed in.
It's baked in. So yeah. To Jesse's question, can we do it? I don't know. Sorry, you're about to say something. Go ahead.
No, I'm always about to say something. But I just make sounds and I'm thinking.
Right.
But there's a lot there. So I think, dude, back early in your, and the points you were making, Jesse, were prefiguring ground. And I think it was a really important thing to bring up. But what was the thing where you started out on that with?
Idea that ideology is the figure, technology.
Oh, it was a QAnon. It was with QAnon.
Yes. Okay. And QAnon as this video game that is so immersive. So yeah, it's like a virtual reality.
I think QAnon is a video game, or is an immersive game, a massive multiplayer role game. Is a great insight. I think it's true. I think it is that. I think people get into it for the sense that it is to some degree a game. People are into it for affiliation groups in the sense that they alone have this thing, and that their prophet Q drops in and says something every once in a while. I've lost one friend to Q. It's a very, very smart network guy, scientist, and I just had to, he had a newsletter. I unsubscribed, and I told him, sorry, dude, I'm off. He got banned from, I think, both Facebook and Twitter. And it's sad. There's no overstating the market for something to believe in. I think that's something that Hugh McLeod has said. I want to say, by the way, that I have certain libertarian sympathies as a Silicon Valley guy, and I think they're mostly along the lines of, please don't make another law right now. We don't know what's going on. You know, I mean, I think the GDPR was in some ways a mistake. I think the CCPA in California was worse, and the new Proposition 24 made it worse than that. One of my one-liners is that every new law protects yesterday from last Thursday, and there's going to last another 100 years. And there's an awful lot of protecting yesterday from last Thursday. So that's, I don't have a gun. I don't, think property is everything, but I am in sympathy with libertarians and in wanting to avoid regulation as much as possible. A problem that we have on the right and the left, by the way, it is a problem for the right is that the left knows how to care, and the problem for the left is the right knows how business works. And that's a problem, because almost everybody on the left is, I used to imagine when I lived in Cambridge or near Cambridge in Massachusetts, the going up along the Charles River, that the thought balloon over MIT was the answer is tech, what is the question? And the thought balloon over Harvard was the answer is policy, is what is the question? Especially since the Harvard Kennedy Center is right there on the river. And the answer to everything is policy. And across the river is the business school, where the answer is money, or the answer is market, and what is the question? And that, and all of those are sort of like positions that people take. But the problem, going back to your point, Jesse, is that, you know, the, and you know, and in this conversation in general, is that the social media that we have now, or the prevailing media that we have now, it's not just social media, it's also what's left of television, it's what we tune into if we're still plugged into cable, is that you're on one side or the other. If you're on CNN, you're looking at this world standing on the left bank, and you're standing on the bank that cares about people, but you've, and on the right, you're looking across and saying these people don't get anything and they're going to raise our taxes. But that's not what it's about. What it's about is this tribalism, and it has to do with making enemies of each other. And that's what Q plays into. It's that those are bad guys. Have any of you seen the new Borat movie by any chance? If you haven't, please do. It's cruel. It's disturbing in some ways. It is horribly funny.
It's hilarious.
It's very hilarious. But there's this where Borat ingratiates himself with a couple of Trump guys that are online every night looking at conspiracy theories, and he asks them, what do you think is worse, Bin Laden or the Democrats? It was something, I don't know, it was some bad guy in the Democrats. Oh, the Democrats. they see the Democrats as the enemy, you know, and he actually, for a while before they realize who he is and they hustle him off the stage, he's leading the crowd of a Trumpless rally in song that he made up, where he's talking about chopping up Democrats like the Saudis do. I mean, and he's getting him to sing along with, chop them up like the Saudis do. That, I mean, that is just fully disturbing. And that is, we know this is what happened in Nazi Germany. I don't mean to go full Godwin on this, but, and I don't think we'll go there. I really don't, because I think that the way that Biden is approaching this is that he's being quietly strong. That's what he's doing. And it's like a little bit of what works on the right and all of what works on the left. And because he's basically a centrist, it'll hopefully bring about some of the best of both. Although I have to say, I'm just really disturbed that his first tech team, I'm told, is like the top privacy person at Facebook and Eric Schmidt from Google. It's like, you just picked the wrong people, dude. So, you know, anyway, because, you know, look for big industry to solve this.
Could I direct the conversation a little differently? And if nobody wants to talk about it, that's fine. Well, Doc, I'm really interested in like a cultural reversal, if you will, something like the counterculture in the 60s, where, you know, the sort of organization man was rejected and there was, you know, this whole countercultural movement. And so I'm wondering what outlines could that take in the current, you know, space of tribalism, social media, et cetera? Could it be young people aspiring to the new cool, which is to throw away your mobile phone or something like that? Or would it be, because I think my sense is we're primed for something like a new counterculture, whether it's a revulsion against what the current narrative failure or a reversion or something. And so I'm real curious what you, because we're old enough, you and I, that we remember it. And so I'm just wondering, what would it be like in today's world?
Well, I mean, my own experience with counterculture was, you know, I went to college in the 60s, graduated in 69. So, and I was in North Carolina. I was in Greensboro. I went to Guilford College there. And which is a pacifist college, basically, and did a very good job of exposing us to all points of view. I have to, hats off to them. But I saw tanks in the streets. I remember, you know, I worked with my buddies to do dangerous things to screw with the Klan. Went to a Klan rally and stole their sign and did a bunch of, and goofed on them. And that was probably a stupid and dangerous thing to do. There are many stories there, but I won't go into, there's actually a couple of stories, but they're big. Anyway, that, but I was involved in civil rights. I was involved in anti-war. I came out as a pacifist. I was going to be a conscientious objector if I didn't get a medical deferment or a fortunate lottery number, which I did. But I thought the war was a horrible idea. And, but I also remember when Martin Luther King was shot, thinking at the time, this is going to set back civil rights at least 50 years. And it was true. It did. I mean, it assassination then actually worked. And in a certain way, not completely, obviously, but it was a giant, the despair is just, there's nothing quite like it. And you know, but, and the counterculture then is just, you know, it's just like, you look back on it and it's like a TV show. I mean, it was long hair and mini skirts and, you know, a lot of goofy stuff, but you know, we were big on all, I mean, we were big on changing the world. I sense something like that happening now. I think the positive protests on the streets have been extraordinarily constructive. I think the Black Lives Matter movement is world changing. I think it's a good thing. You know, even though the violence that's happened alongside it, I don't like, but I understand it. I have a lot of hope for young people. I do, probably for every generation. You know, for my parents' generation, it was going to war. You know, it was fighting the Depression and going to war, and that was how they acted. And you know, I mean, it's interesting. In my case, I have two generations of kids. I have, you know, my wife and I have three in their late 40s. One is turns 51 today, and we have one who's 24, and he lives in Brooklyn with some other, you know, kids that just got out of college, and they are, you know, they're on the streets and they're cheering this thing on, and you know, and they're, you know, but it's not counterculture in the sense that they're fighting the prevailing culture like we were back then. It was like, we talked about the establishment, and the establishment was you know, White's organization man from the 1950s, right? That was, he did a great job. It was, what was his first name, William White? Anyways, White, I have his book over there somewhere. You know, we were rebelling against that. I don't think that this generation is rebelling against anything, but they're terribly empowered, I think. And terribly is probably the wrong adverb.
Allow me to pivot that slightly, but yeah, still on the same spirit, yeah, or the same thought. Is open source countercultural? And
no.
Or where does open source fit within this larger sort of constellation, both in terms of power, in terms of the digital platforms, or to your point about Schmidt, yeah, and the Facebook dude becoming part of the administration?
I want to tack on
is
a
open
writer.
Source part of the establishment, or is it, you know, something different?
And then same question to blockchain and crypto.
Okay, yeah.
Over to you.
I don't think any of them are I think they're revolutionary without being about revolution. I think that, to me, the best example of something like open source was Frame Construction. There's a guy named Augustine Taylor who in Chicago, I think it was in 1834, basically invented frame construction. Already laying around were what they called cut nails, which are the kinds shaped like little wedges or triangles. There'd be a sheet of metal. You could fabricate a sheet of metal, score it on little angles, and then break them up, and you had these nails with a rectangular head. And if you look on floorboards and you see rectangular heads, they're from that generation. What we use now are called wire nails because they're extruded as a single kind of long cylinder. But those already were in the world, and so were sawmills. And it was Taylor's idea to basically make 2x4s and 2x6s and frame up something in basically the way we've been framing up houses ever since. Before that, we had dovetail joints and mortise and tenon, which is where you put like a tab at the, you cut your log so there's like a tab at the end and it goes into a hole in another log. A lot of old barns were built this way. And everything was custom. And what Taylor invented for making a church in Chicago took off because it allowed anybody to be a carpenter. Anybody could be a carpenter. If you could have them mill a bunch of 2x4s. I don't know if they called them 2x4s then, but basically it was an easy thing to measure. And you made studs and joists and you built the thing up and you could put anything on the outside. You could have, you could have prairie style. You could have bungalows. You could have Tudor. You could have, modern. It didn't matter. Everything got built that way after that. And that's kind of what open source was. And also it wasn't patented. You know, somebody thought of it. A lot of other people copied it. It brought lots and lots of people into it. And they could start making new things using this method. Basically, open source is an approach to construction. It's just an approach to construction where the contents of materials are fully exposed. And we could talk about licenses and how, those restrict to some degree or empower different uses of the materials. But it's basically a way of approaching construction materials and construction methods. And I think, blockchain and crypto are kind of in the same area. Crypto has been around forever, as long as we've had math. I think, we could secret something in altering, sequences and so forth. But I think, encoding is an old thing. I mean, in its own weird way, binary code is crypto. If you don't know how that works, it's crypto to you, right? So, but I'm one of the people who helped promulgate open source at Linux Journal. I was a great evangelist for it. And it was very effective, and it's, that what I did and what more consequential people, especially Eric Raymond, did at that time, were important. But it's done. I mean, it's in the world now. People understand what it means. I don't think it's especially revolutionary at this point. It's revolutionary in the sense that it happened and it changed a lot of the way the code is now. What I lament is that some of the moral imperatives behind it are lost, or forgotten, or half forgotten. There's a generation or two that has come along since then that, they'll work with open source code. They understand there it is in GitHub. I can add to it. I can pick it up. I can use it. I can reuse lots of things. But kind of lost in it is how are what I call because effects. You make money because of something rather than with it. It really bothers me, for example, when people say, the business model of the internet or of the web is advertising. That's like saying the business model of sunlight is vacations. It's not. I mean, sunlight, you can do lots of things with sunlight. The fact that, a lot of people are doing vacations with it doesn't mean that that's the business model of sunlight. It has no business model. Open source code has no business model, but it allows an incalculable amount of business to happen, right? So it's about making business happen. It's about making society happen. It's about making progress happen. But yet the urge to lock things down, the urge to control, the urge to put things behind paywalls, to imagine you can make money with code rather than because of it, is undiminished. And that's disappointing to me. But I take heart in knowing that this approach to writing code and keeping things secret in the case of crypto, of sharing things, is in the world. It's not going to go away. And these are genies that have long since escaped from theirs and are busy granting deals everywhere. And we're not going to stop it.
Do you think VRM as an approach is one of those genies that has escaped and is in the world for good? Or do you think it's something that has yet to achieve some kind of critical mass and get out there?
I think it's both. I think it's a genie that's out there saying, hey, what do you want? You know, and you know, nobody's listening. Yeah. Or it's not noticing. I mean, we have, you know, probably hundreds of developers that are hip to it and want to do something in that area. We have very few investors. And you know, it's, I mean, just to be clear, VRM stands for vendor relationship management. It's thought of as the customer side of customer relationship management, and CRM is how companies know you or think they know you. Mostly they don't. But it's how the, you know, the CVS store remembers who you are, and it gives you an app, and, you know, remembers your prescriptions, reminds you of them. Those are all done with CRM systems. And that's like, what, a $50 billion business. It's a B2B business. There are a few big operators in it, Oracle, SAP, Microsoft Dynamics, a few others, Salesforce. These are, you know, but on our side, what have we got? Actually nothing, or pretty close to nothing. Nothing that really engages those things that we could. Ideally, you should be able, for example, to change your last name or change your address or your phone number for every company you're dealing with in one move. Your credit card expires, and I gotta let 50 companies know that my credit card's expired. How do I do that? Well, I go like a bee from flower to flower to flower to flower to every one of these little websites, and you know, or I make a phone call to change it, because you're dealing with that many different CRM systems, often have the same back end. So you should be able to deal in some common way with those. There are ways that we should have for expressing loyalty, ways to subscribe and unsubscribe, ways to advertise what we're interested in and at the moment we're interested in them, and in a secure way where we're not going to get bothered by marketing till the end of time. And so far on the business side, you know, this moment, even though the GDPR and the CCPA have done their best to make them this practice illegal, think that they can know us better than we know ourselves, and that loving their customer consists of following that customer around and bothering them with promotional messages. And, you know, regardless of whatever the privacy implications of that are. And my angle on that is that, you know, I mean, just to put this in perspective, you know, the Project VRM has been around since 2006. And even though I'm an alumnus fellow at the Berkman Klein Center, I still run that project there, which consists of, you know, a wiki, a blog, and a mailing, occasional events. But, and we do have spinoffs like Customer Commons, which is a nonprofit that I'm on. You know, that's been around, you know, now 14 years. And the book you waved earlier, the Intention Economy, that's been around, you know, for almost 8 years. Okay. And when I wrote that, I thought I was late. So far, I'm 8 years early. Okay. I mean, it's no doubt, if I had to write that book again now, and I've thought about it several times, but I would change in it, other than the names of the dead companies that were the early pioneers that died off. And they're not all dead. Some of them morphed into something else, and the people who did them are still alive. Most of them are. But it's, I think the idea, the basic idea is, you know, free customers are more valuable than captive ones. And, you know, CRM wants to capture customers. And we have, you know, and a corollary of that is that you can have far more vital and energetic and growing markets if there is better signaling from demand to supply than supply alone can provide with its tools. In other words, if we have better ways of talking to companies than what they're just handing out to us, saying, you know, do what we're doing here and our menu has changed. You know, I mean, that's what they're doing now. And it's lame, and it's incredibly lame. And we don't think it's dangerous or bad because they're so bad at it. You know, but you know, anyway.
Oh, we think it's dangerous and bad, at least among us. But you meant, you know, something, another book that has been making the rounds between us is Subprime Attention Crisis.
The great Tim Hwang.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's
the book you saved me from writing.
Yeah. And yeah. So not only has the time come for VRM, it's the yeah. other way around. CRM, there's ample evidence that it doesn't even work anyway. So it's this
well
multi-billion dollar business that's just achieving suboptimal results.
Well, to be fair to CRM, that Tim's critique is not of CRM. It's really of the surveillance industrial complex, and its basic case is
they're interconnected, though.
Oh, they're interconnected, but most people who work in the CRM world and the CX world, customer experience world, they are not, for the most part, thinking and talking about surveillance. Some of what they do is that, but most of what they do is not that, and it's not worth going into that, especially. But the Tim, you know, to put Tim's work in perspective on that, you know, I wrote about the bubble bursting, the EdTech bubble bursting, in 2008. You know, I mean, it, if you go to, and I can give you the link, but I mean, if it's on my blog, I have a list of 136 essays and blog posts and articles I've written, you know, for MIT, you know, Wall Street Journal, MIT Tech Review, others, all about the same thing, you know, how this thing's going to collapse. It's Wile E. Coyote after he's gone off the cliff, except that years have passed with Wile E. Coyote floating in the air, right? You know, and people like me are the roadrunner down there below honking at him, waiting for him to die, to fall, and is not. But it will happen. So, you know, I was predicting.
But what if it's the other way around? What if we're the coyote, and we don't understand how that roadrunner keeps staying alive? We're like, we've blown it up. We've had all these traps.
Oh yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. I think that, you know, I think of my writing at this point is kind of like the water on a rock. I mean, it's like, you know, I just want to get more of it into the world so that when it happens, people always say, yeah, he said that, and now here's some of what he suggested that might work, or what other people too. I mean, it's not just me. I mean, I try to source, you know, very generously at all times, because, you know, we do stand on the shoulders of giants and all that, you know, and Tim and I have been on that same ride for a long time, you know. And I try not to be bothered by the fact that Tim doesn't mention anything I wrote in that book, and it's fine, you know. You know, nor did Shoshana Zuboff in her book. But I thought it was a great book, and I told her so, and she put a blurb for me on the back cover. So I am in the book, right? But the thing is, it's really important. You know, I forget who said it. Maybe it was one of our ex-presidents here. You know, that there's no telling how effective you could be if you don't want the credit, right? And I've never wanted the credit, actually. I've never worked for credit. I've always tried to give other people credit. And I want Tim to get a lot of credit for having, I think Subprime Attention Crisis is a great title, and I hope the book's a big success. But, you know, we have a good friend in the UK who may have been the biggest real-time bidding. This is where your data is sold on a live market as you're going about the web operations in the UK. He got out of it in early 2017, and he said it's going down later this year. 2017, that's, you know, that was 3 years ago, you know, more than 3 years ago when he said it. And he was right, you know, and he got out with his fuck you money, presumably. Jesse, you just disappeared into your background like you were taken.
Yes.
You know, taken even further north.
Charles, were you, sorry, did I just cut you off, Doc?
No, you didn't.
Charles, were you getting ready to say something? I saw your notes earlier, so
I'm just taking pages of notes because it's such a great conversation. But no, I take it away.
What you said about, you know, we've been waiting, the VRM sort of side of the equation has been waiting for the ad tech bubble to burst and for years and years. And so I'm over in a different space. I mean, I run a tech company, but it's a tiny one, like infinitesimal. But I'm a finance kind of wonk, and I've been waiting for like the same kind of, you know, come down from artificially inflated valuations and QE-induced unicorn economies and things
like
that.
How about just real estate prices? I mean,
real estate prices too.
Come on.
I know. I know.
Yeah.
And it's just happening. It's everywhere. It's kind of endemic in the system. Now, I will always say it comes back to the structure of the monetary system. Cue the groans from the audience. But, and we won't get into it today because it's a whole different episode to talk about that. Yeah. But
have to have my wife on for that one. She's our crypto and blockchain specialist.
Okay.
But yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. I mean, we are coming up on the hour.
I'm
here for as long as you want, by the way. If you want to go long, I'm fine. What's that,
Jesse? Bring it back full circle, because I think we should wrap up. You know, I think this all comes down to narrative. And I think it comes down to the way in which narrative amplifies values. And part of what the pandemic did was interrupt a lot of the narratives that had been governing society. So it feels as if we're in this period in which those narratives can be renegotiated. And part of what you guys just expressed in two different ways was the kind of bubble disbelief that there are certain narratives that are continue to move forward that we just don't understand how they're able to not burst. And mine was, right? There's a part of me that goes, I don't understand how QAnon continues. At a certain point, these false predictions that continue to not come true, you know, when do people disbelieve? When do they shake their head? And to go back to the Wile E. Coyote metaphor, that's when I realized that as the observer, my perspective didn't matter. It's the perspective of the subject, of the user, that matters. And to the user of QAnon, they're a hero on a worthy quest. And so, of course, that's never going to end. The quest focus may shift.
No, it's like a...
But
it's
their
like
position may not. Go ahead.
Well, a couple of things. One is, you know, I mean, first, just to tie a bow on your, you know, maybe we're, you know, the roles reversed, the Wile E. Coyote, and we've been, you know, and that AdTech is the roadrunner that'll never die. And it's possible. I mean, I think it's actually kind of true until it's not. And that can happen anytime. I think that Tim is right that there is a crisis there. It will crash. As for the monetary side, I'm very curious about economics, and I'm not schooled in it at all. One of my sons is, and I don't think he buys a damn thing that I say. So I think he's nice about it, but he's not especially interested or motivated by it. And so, but I do think that there is a sort of weird house of cardsy feel to everything about that. And as for narrative, I mean, you know, if we had not, I mean, I really do believe if we had not had the pandemic, Trump would have just won in a landslide. You know, I mean, because the economy was basically good. You know, it was good for people. They were happy enough. He was there. He was a show. Even if you thought he lied all the time. And frankly, if he'd been a better leader, if he'd said, hey, you know, on day two, hey, look, I'm going to act the strong guy. I'm going to nationally require that people wear masks, and people are going to get testing. We're going to do all this stuff. We're going to coordinate it nationally. I'm going to bring the military in. I'm going to do all this stuff. If he'd done that, he'd have been huge. But unfortunately, he's stupid, and so he didn't. And so that was the problem. I think he's extraordinarily gifted as a charismatic character, but he's also stupid in ways that also count. So there it went. And now we have Biden, and we'll see what happens. But the problem there is that we have narratives in which the other side is not just wrong, it's the enemy. That's what bothers me about QAnon. That's what bothers me about a lot of these things. And especially on the right, they're looking at the left as Democrats are bad. And that, you know, that bothers me. And it bothers me that on the left, and I mostly hang out in academic circles, right, and those are mostly on the left, there's not an appreciation of what the right does get right or might get right, which has nothing to do with Trump and everything to do with maybe we don't need a lot of new taxes. Maybe we don't need a lot of new laws. Maybe we don't need big government. Maybe we don't, you know, and I think everybody brings something to the table. I think the U.S. has an important place in the world, but, you know, I also don't think we need to have a gigantic military. I just don't. And that's going to be a very hard thing to unwind. But maybe we do, and I don't know, you know, I don't know, you know, but I think patience is the thing. I mean, I do expect most of whatever I've brought to the world to have effects after I'm gone. I'm not a young guy. I'm in great shape. I'm happy. My mind is intact and all that, but you know, we all get old and die, you know, if we're lucky. And you know, my joke about it is that I know I'm in the exit queue, but I just let other people cut in. You know, that's, you know, hey, you go ahead. I'm fine. I'm over here. I don't need it. No, that's fine. You go ahead.
So, that's funny.
Anyway, yeah, it's important to see the irony in everything, right? I mean, because that's what makes the world fun, is nothing but irony, right? More than one meaning for everything.
Well, at the risk of opening up the door to an entirely new episode, we do want to get a transhumanist on here one of these days to sort of get their take on why we may be the last generation to ever experience death, but I don't really think that it's a viable proposition.
Let me put it this way. I forget who was it. Maybe it was Orson Scott Card.
Jesse beamed up.
I know. Who's the? One of the science fiction writers wrote about how, you know, there was some alien species that worship humans because humans were mortal.
Yes. Yeah. Yes,
yeah,
I know.
Whoever wrote that.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, as I get older, I really do. I do see morality as a grace and not as a curse. I think Ray Kurzweil is a really interesting guy, but he's going to die. Okay. But if we all end up being immortal, then he'll be a god, right? He'll be remembered as a martyr to the cause, you know? So, but I do think mortality is a grace. I think it's important to move on. And I also think the human species is too big. and I think our population footprint is too large and has been for a long time. And I don't have any program for dealing with that. And I don't want to have one, but I do think that's a fact.
Birth control is a pretty easy one.
It is a pretty easy one. And you know, that's the whole other thing. But the transhumanists would be fun to have on. I know some. If you're looking for some, there's some great authors and writers I can throw at you. Brett Frischman, by the way, who wrote with Evan Selinger, Reengineering Humanity. He's a law professor at Villanova, and he's great. He wrote a book called Shepherd's, a novel called Shepherd's Drone, which I'm reading now. He wrote the work on infrastructure, which is a very thick book. But he's incredibly smart and. But also a jock. He plays sports. He's an all-around guy. But he'd be great to have on the show.
Cool.
Yeah. I like the way you appear and disappear there. It's interesting when you half appear, you look like you're behind the trees, and you're very large.
Out here in the country, the internet's so bad. Out here in the country.
Where are you out near Ottawa somewhere? Is that what I heard? Yeah, excellent. Seen any auroras yet this year?
We're not that far north.
Yeah, you should. Well, they come down south sometimes. I've seen them in New York, so it happens.
It happens.
It happens. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, Doc. And I've taken almost two pages of notes, old style, but nonetheless, the conversation has been terrific. And I mean, there's a couple books right here in these two pages. But,
oh, great. I don't have to write the book then. One of you guys do it. But anybody wants to send me an email or get in touch with me, feel free. I'm doc@searles.com. You know, firstname@lastname.com.
Great. And then the Project VRM list, I would recommend anyone who's interested.
Yeah, it's a good list.
About that. You Google it, you find it, because I don't know the exact URL, but I will put it in the show notes.
It's a long URL, but if you dig around at the Project VRM blog, you can find it.
And I'll link to it in the show notes.
Okay, great.
Okay. Well, thanks again for coming on, and we'll have you on again sometime.
Okay. Thank you guys, too. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay. Take care, Doc.
Take care.
All right.
Okay.